privilege to introduce to you guys tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Jim, which has 12 years sober. Thank you.
Sobriety month as well, but I thought I might even be up here later, so I've had like three hugs from Nora tonight. I'd like to say a couple things first of all about this meeting. This meeting didn't exist until Bill Hapsman decided that we should have this meeting. And, I spoke here about 8 years ago, and this is just a really, really very, very cool thing, celebration of sobriety. And I'm so happy that he called me, and I'm so happy to be here to have a chance to share my experience drinking and work with you. I'd also like to say a couple of other things. I noticed these little different colored chips from every month. When I got sober, they only had 1, 3, 6, 9. And they're like, dude, this is 2 months. And so I found a place that had 2 and 4, and I rewarded myself. I don't know if that's weird, but I did. Yeah. Anyway, my name's Jim. My home group is the Monday Night Men's Stag Meeting here in Visalia. We meet at the PPAE Hall from 7:30 to 9. My sobriety date is July the 16th, 2002. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I grew up in a kind of, as you listen to Alcoholics Talk and the home that we grew up with, and my father left, my mother remarried, and we were adopted. And we weren't adopted because my dad wanted to leave us or anything. I think he just probably didn't want to pay the money, So I was raised by a loving mother and a hard-drinking college professor who didn't like or understand kids. But we had a lot of rum and whatever they make martinis with, I don't know. And there was a big beer keg in the garage. And so anytime there was anything going on in our home, there was always alcohol was always involved. It really didn't matter what it was. We were well provided for. We had a pond in the back that was stocked with catfish and bass and a couple of sailboats. We had a donkey. If you're old enough to know what Baines is, if you know what the B in LBJ is, then you'll know what the old year in my era, you know. So we had a horse for a while and some cows and chickens. And, you know, it was very cool. But there was a lot of booze around. But I always did well in school. My sister and I always did well in school. And I was involved a little bit in sports, but I got involved in playing music, and that was really, really something that I really, really loved. And I loved to perform, and I got good at it pretty fast. And my brother was already successful as a musician, and he helped me improve. And then I began to kind of get a reputation as a decent musician. When I was about, I don't know, 12 or 13, one of my cousins had a reception, and it was an Italian-type reception, and so there was a lot of vino, and so I mixed the red and the white, you know, what the heck, you know. And I like to say that my drinking career started with incomprehensible demoralization, because I had to take my retainer out of the vomit, you know, and that was one of my early drinking memories. But I was very shy, and I couldn't talk to girls, and I remember this one time I wanted to ask this girl to go somewhere, I don't know, and I was so afraid I made a recording, and I held the recording to the phone when she answered, and I was shaking my head. And it finished, and she said, "What?" "Oh my God, I have to speak." At that moment, when I drank that wine, it made me social. It made me feel like I could talk to somebody like that. I didn't become a drinker that day, but I remembered that feeling that I got when I was under the influence there as a young teenager. In high school, I continued to get good grades, was a good student. I became known a little bit more for my musical ability. And then kind of more, I didn't really plan on this, but kind of as a partying guy. My sophomore year, summer, probably is when that started. It was easy to get beer. Taggers happened all the time. And I remember CHB, I was about, I don't know, 17, I just bought a six-pack, and I looked about 12, and he said, well, pour out the open one and do the rest of your drinking inside, you know. That doesn't happen now, but that's my experience. So I learned that alcohol I wasn't old enough to do it, but I learned that they don't penalize you, so what the heck, you know, it seemed like we got involved with the police a lot, you know, and I remember one time we were pulled over and I just spent a lot of time preparing a bunch of other issues. And there was a lot of them in this bag. And my buddy goes, I'm getting pulled over. And I said, okay, all right. And so I stuffed them in the glove box and he asked for the registration. So they roll right out, you know, and so it's like, hey, what do you have there? And so, you know, we step out of the car and he says, I'm taking this for evidence, but I'm not putting it on the ticket. Well, I wonder what that guy did. Alcohol to me when I was growing up was fun. It gave me confidence. It gave me freedom to be the person I always wanted to be but couldn't figure out how to be without booze. All the while, my scholastic achievement remained good. To quote Alfred E. Newman of Mad Magazine, what? Me worry? You know, I mean, everything was fine, you know. So I just kept doing what I was doing. I'm going to talk a little bit about relationships because I'm not very good at that. And I wasn't good at it as a kid. I hurt many, many, many fine young ladies, and I really didn't care that much about their feelings. At one high school dance, it was kind of like a game to me, and I tried to be with three different girls at the same time, and so it really took a lot of work. But needless to say, that evening crashed and burned. But those are the things I tried to do, and if they were mad at me, well, so what? You know, I didn't understand how people could get hurt by my actions, and that didn't change for a long, long time. It says that when we start drinking in earnest, we don't mature. That means when I stopped for good at 42, I was still a teenager. When I look back, I believe this is true. My first marriage ended in divorce, and after that divorce was final, I was married again in less than 6 months. I think what Gary Tunes said, his dad had told him, son, I think your marriages are overlapping. That didn't happen to me, but I don't know if it was something inside of me that just needed companionship, or when I think back now after a few years of sobriety, I think I just didn't want to be with myself, and I needed somebody there. What's the saying? Your head is a dangerous place. Don't go there alone. That's true for me, definitely. My second marriage, which is still going after 25 years, and I'm blessed with a woman that has tolerated me at my worst. Whether it was for the kids, love, or for some other reason, I'm grateful for her love, patience, understanding, and support. And I'm thankful she's here tonight. Here in AA, remember, we're dealing with a mental teenager here, right? The relationships between my wife, my parents, and my children have been restored due to the steps of AA and the simple suggestions that are made here. This has only happened because I like to say that I lived the steps rather than I work the steps. And I prefer to live the steps because, well, work sounds like work. And it's amazing to me that this seemingly helpless state of mind and body can be repaired if there is a certain magical event. And for me, that magical event was identification. In 1992, I started an annual memorial golf tournament for a couple of friends of mine that passed away in a car crash. Ironically, I was supposed to be with them, but I was unable to attend the dinner because I was principal trumpet at the time in the Torrey County Symphony, and we had a rehearsal where something was going on. About two blocks from my house, I was pulled over at .24. I'm 32 years old. I've been a daily drinker for many, many years. And I figured it was my reward for a successful career. I had gone into education very, very young at 22. And my groups have been very successful. And I thought that I deserved it for the hard work and everything that I put in. By this time, I had a master's degree, and I considered myself deserving to spend my evenings doing what I did. I thought, the legend in my own mind that I thought I was, that this was just a little blip on my historical radar screen. Well, I was sentenced off to the road camp, and I still thought it wasn't my fault. If only, you know, fill in the blank. I just couldn't take responsibility. One Saturday, I had to hoe the weeds at the offices of the county superintendent of schools. I worked for him, and he allowed me to be married in his backyard, and there I was with a little vest on or whatever they threw on us, you know, and I had my hat down as low as it would go. And, oh, gosh. But was I demoralized? No, not yet. Killing my principal wasn't too hard, and he didn't punish me in any way. He told me that, you know, story about himself, that he didn't go where I went, but he almost did, and he got home. And, you know, when you get that sentence, you have to attend classes and do this. And the classes at Alternate Services were very, very good. I had a wonderful counselor named Skeety Tharp. She was very, very good to me, and I pretty much was as dishonest with her as I could be with anyone. I just could not face the fact that the rest of my life, all my friends and were going to be having fun, and I was not going to be able to be a part of that. And as a result, couldn't look at myself as an alcoholic. I just could not identify. I went to the shortest meetings I could find, and by chance, that happened to be the one that I was able to go to quite a bit, was the noon meeting at the Alano Club. Now, the noon meeting at the Alano Club is a wonderful cultural event. And I tell you what, as soon as I got there, I could point to people, I'm not like you, I'm not like you, I'm not like you, I'm not like you. But then there was this guy, his name was Curtis. He's a very strong, athletic African-American guy. And he got up there and spoke, and when he spoke, he commanded your attention. And Curtis said a couple of things that I remembered, but it really wasn't for me, you know, it was for other people. I remember him saying, you took 25 years to come here and you want to get fixed overnight, you know, and it was like, well, yeah, that's kind of what I want, you know, and I didn't hear the part about that's not the way it works, you know, but I still didn't think that what they were saying here in AA applied to me. In a few days, I was back to my old pattern of drinking, driving, and neglecting my family. There was a slight bit of identification, but it was mainly when somebody told a funny story or something that I could relate to. I continued on this path for another 8 years, gradually increasing in everything wrong that I was doing, until New Year's in 2000. In New Year's in 2000, I was up on a band performing for VIPs at the Bellagio Casino on the Strip in Las Vegas. And everything was on the house, the lobster, the steak, the whatever you want. And it's funny because my sister Trish from Susanville is here, and she called me and said, "I'm coming." And I said, "Well, you can't get in. They got dogs. There's multiple security." And Trish identified as an alcoholic, and when we played, and then the Harry Connick Band came on and played, and then brought everyone into New Year's, and then right after 12, we started again, and I looked out on the dance floor at 12:15, and there's my sister dancing. So she figured out a way. Don't we all wish? But anyway, the next day I woke up, and they drug us in a van to the airport, and the next thing I remember was waking up at the Burger King in Newhall, California, and I really am not sure how I got there, how long I slept. At that point, I looked at myself and I said, "Man, you can't keep doing this. You got to stop this." And so, so I did it the way that I figured I could. You know, here I am. I'm educated, and I can beat this thing. And yeah, I attended a little AA, but I don't really need that. I just need to stop drinking. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll buy a 12-pack of beer, and I won't drink it. So I did. I bought a 12-pack of beer, and we have this fridge in the garage. And every day when I went to work, I walked right past it, you know. And I came home, I walked right past it, you know. And I did that for 23 days. And I really wanted a commendation from the mayor, but it never came. You know, I thought, well, I overestimated this alcohol stuff. And then a friend of mine came over, and he brought his guitar, and he was trying to show me how to do these blues chords and these set of chords. And he brought a six-pack of beer, and, well, how could I turn that down, you know? And so I took that one beer, and that one beer propelled me for another 2.5 years. To the path of incomprehensible demoralization, because I didn't want to be drinking, and I found myself unable to stop. Around that time, a lady in our district passed away from a terrible disease, and it hit fast, and she passed away very fast during the school year while she was still teaching. And the district union came to us and said, we are offering catastrophic illness insurance, and if you like it, it's here for a few weeks or something, you can enroll in it. And my thinking was this, well, this is great. All I have to do is get this insurance, I'll keep drinking. When I need a new liver, I'll just check, you know, check it in and cash in that insurance, and I'll be great. Can we all agree that that's insane? So I can't stop, and the real crazy thing is now I've accepted not that I was an alcoholic, but I've accepted I would just continue on this crazy path of self-destruction, and that's what it was. Home life was not nice because I wasn't really, really a part of it. I'm not proud of that. But there's something here that we have that we're able to fix stuff with, and it's the power of the 12 steps. And because of those 12 steps, those wounds have healed for the most part. Some of them I don't know ever will. And I remember Bob from Lemoore saying that he could never, ever, ever repay to his wife the grief that he comes through. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but and I try to remember that because every time I want to be a certain me and get my way, I try to remember that, because that's how it works, at least for me around here. You know, you hear something and it'll stick with you for years. Just coming over here, you know, I hear people, they talk about driving all the time, you know, and I'm on Court Street, and I'm in a little Honda car, and there's one of these four-wheel drives that's about 10 feet off the ground behind me, and I see this tire in my rearview mirror, you know, and he's honking because I'm not going 40 or something, you know, and I thought to myself, well, what the F, you know, but I just moved into the other lane, let him go, you know. It's just like, gee, I didn't used to do that, you know. Like, I really am different now, you know. But this path that I was on, I was just okay with the way it was, and I figured since I can't change it, I'll just keep doing it. I had really lost hope that I could ever live a life without alcohol. This reached ahead when I was arrested a second time, but this time my kids and their friends were taken from me. My wife had to come to Hume Lake to get them, and I was taken to the Fresno County Jail with a .21 blood alcohol content. This is interesting because that particular day, I felt like talking. And park ranger, which I noticed later, said enforcement or whatever, law enforcement or something, somewhere else on the truck. It didn't look like a cop car to me. She was done, and she drove off, and I had just a few more things to say, and I flagged her down again, you know. When my attorney saw that, dude, you got off and you went back. You wouldn't have given me $1,000 if you'd just gone away. Go fishing. But you know what? I wasn't finished talking to her, and I think that was God talking to me. I think God was saying, this thing has gone far enough. You know, you have you've run alcohol's course, and you have lost. I didn't realize it at the time. It was kind of an inconvenience. It was a huge inconvenience for my wife, because not only was it my kids, it was their friend's kids. And so we had to go to them and said, yeah, the camping party is now officially over, and Jim's spending the night somewhere else. And so, yeah, it was. There was a lot of stress coming out of that at home. But it was in that ranger car that that I had what they call a psyche change or a moment of clarity. And I had prayed a lot. And my mother taught us to pray, and I was baptized, and we weren't regular church attenders, but you know, kids, you believe in God, you know. And then you go to college, and God sometimes is not in the forefront, and certainly with a lot of liberal college professors. And so, you pray, help me find my keys, help me find my car, you know, whatever, those kind of prayers, you know. But this was the first time that I ever really sincerely prayed from the depths of my soul, God help me, I can't do this. And if you're there, then take this away. So, I asked God to do that, and I get a phone call, and so I'm down there in the jail, and I call a friend who lives in Aubrey. If you know Fresno and Aubrey, it's way up in the foothills, and he told me later, he didn't tell me then, but he was with his wife, and let's just say they weren't holding hands. Anyway, he left and came down and took me all the way back to Hume Lake. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, but at 2:30 in the morning on July 15, 2002, I got up in that little trailer, went to the fridge, and I opened a beer, and I had my last beer. Actually, it was a Natural Light. Why did I buy Natural Light? You all know. Because it's cheap and the alcohol content blows away any beer on the shelf, you know. And so, natty ice, baby, yeah. So, after that beer, that really began my journey here. I went back to my pastor, and I told him what had happened, and he recommended a meeting at our church, which is Christ Lutheran, on Friday night, and he recommended another one in the Blue Room at Cuyahoga Delta Hospital. And so, since I had these cards now, and I had to go and get them signed, I went to the Blue Room. And on the Blue Room, I don't remember the date, but it was my first time going down the stairs and into that big room, and I got called on the first night. and I heard myself say, my name's Jim and I'm alcoholic. And I was okay with it. You know, it's one thing to think it, it's another thing, but when you hear yourself say it, at least for me, it's kind of a big deal. Then they wanted me to share it. Like, well, I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm here, isn't that enough, you know? But another thing happened that night. Two people reached out to me. One was a guy named Chuck. He was from Texas or Arizona or New Mexico or somewhere. And he gave me a card. And another guy, he's an angel in heaven now, and his name was Kelly Dock. And Kelly wrote on a card, call anytime. And I was completely blown away that someone that I just met would tell me, when you're having a problem, call me anytime. I said, that's what's here? That kind of love, that kind of support, was something that really, really had a powerful effect on me. I believe God sent those two men to me at that moment when I was introduced at my weakest point. And they introduced AA in such a manner that they allowed me to feel like I belonged. I strongly advise anyone who sees someone new to reach out to them, because it could be the moment where they decide A is for them. Whether you're smiling or frowning could make the difference. If you ignore them, that could make the difference. I continue to attend meetings, but the big push for me to get this wonderful program was from a wonderful ex-postmaster from Farmersville, California, named Don W. Now, Don was my youth counselor, and if you knew Don, who is also, God rest his soul, passed away, I couldn't lie to Don. I tried. I thought about it, actually. I didn't really try. If you knew Don, he was old school AA, and that's exactly what I needed. I needed someone who, there was no BS, that it was straight, and this is the way you're going to do it, and I just did exactly everything he said. As a result of that, I began to learn to be honest with myself and to myself. I took a position as literature dude with the Sunday night meeting, and I was so proud. I later became the secretary and also became involved with the central office for many, many years as a CSR and also as a vice president. I was still learning, but I didn't really completely identify with the AA program until I went to the Ritchie Barn Dance the next April. And that's when Cliff Roach, a retired school teacher from Oceanside, California, spoke. You see, Cliff was a high school teacher and I identified with everything he spoke of. As a result, the AA program became real and meaningful to me, and I felt that I had hope. I began listening to CDs of Clancy Innesland and Dr. Paul Olinger, who wrote the famous chapter on acceptance, and the many other great AA speakers, past and present, who are on the circuit. I knew I belonged now. It's funny, because in my early days of sobriety, I was so proud of me, and I thought others would be too. It seemed I forgot that I walked all over people to get where I was, and now I wanted every one of them to put a statue of me in my front yard. That's not the way it works. I began to mature from my teenage mind into a helpful, caring adult, and it didn't happen overnight. The 12 steps made me look at me and the hurricane of destruction that I left in my wake. Co-workers, family, friends, children, relatives, no one was spared. The saying that every problem that you have, you are responsible for, bothered me at first, but I began to understand what they meant. I hated that when I came to AA meetings and they said, well, look at yourself, look at yourself, look at yourself. And it's like, no, I don't want to look at myself. Well, what do I need to do? Look at myself, look at myself. You know, and that's what I need to do, because it's absolutely true. If I have a problem, I'm a part of it. My source for solutions was the Big Book, Friends in AA, and a caring sponsor, which I still have after 12 years, the same guy, I just talked to him today. He guided me through the steps, and so I'm able to live them and not work them. I think of you first now, and that's new for me. AA showed me how I could become the person I always wanted to be, but never knew I could. I say these things now not to brag, but to show you what has happened to me in the past 12 years. I had two DUIs on my record, 1992 and 2002. I'm a public school educator. By every means, they could simply say, don't come back tomorrow. But they didn't do that. I was in a very, very tenuous position at home with my family and my wife, and things were not looking good on any front with me. I didn't have a license. I had to ride the bus 35 miles one way every morning at 4:20. I got on my bicycle in the rain and the dark and whatever, fog, and I did that for 6 months. But that was very therapeutic. That was a good sentence. The guy was sleeping. That was good. I needed that. I needed time to look at me. But since that happened, and since they let me keep my job, and my wife didn't leave, and my kids say they love me, I've been fortunate enough to play trumpet solos two times since I've been sober in Carnegie Hall in New York City. I've conducted at Lincoln Center, and in 2012, I was named the Torrey County Educator of the Year. I don't say that. Thank you. I don't say that, but when I look back that I was in danger of losing my job, my family, and everything important in my life, and those things happen here, if I'm drinking, those things don't happen, because I don't keep that job, I don't keep my lovely family, I don't see my two grandkids, you know, and I can do those things now. I gotta speed it up. Okay, from this brink of absolute disaster, I've been reborn into a successful person who can look you in the eye. That was very hard for me. Number one, I always had booze on my breath. Didn't want to look you in the eye. But the second most important thing is when I'm looking you in the eye, I'll listen to what you're saying. And I didn't do that. I grew up in AA. I thank God that I had the mind of a teenager when I got here, because I have been shaped and molded into the person that I am now, and it is just a miracle. We have here in Torrey County something that some of you know about, many of you don't. And it's called the Birthday Club. I stopped by Exeter yesterday and wrote him a check for $12, and that's all you got to do. If you want to join the Birthday Club, send a check to the central office for the number of years of sobriety that you have. If everybody in Torrey County and Kings County did that, our financial problems in the central office would disappear. So that's my suggestion. That's my pitch for central office, because I have a history there. Join the Birthday Club and give a buck for every year that you've been sober. I'm just going to say one more quick thing. Do I have a couple minutes? Okay. One of my sponsees told me, he heard that I had gotten sober, and he told the person that he was talking to, no way, Jimmy's a drunk. Well, because of step 12, I'm not a drunk, and now neither is he, with over a year and 4 or 5 months of sobriety. I hope that's how it works for you, and you, and you, and everyone in this room. Thank you so much for letting me speak tonight. God bless you.